Hello and welcome to the 70th episode of An Imperfect Leader, the Superintendents and Leadership Podcast, a series where leaders look back at decisions they made and ask themselves, what happened? What got overlooked? What did I learn about relationships? What frustrated me? And in the end, what was something that was good that came out of the experience? Because it's through our mistakes where our greatest learning takes place. My guest today holds a special place in my professional life. I met him during his first campaign for the school board, and then we maintained a friendship even when he unexpectedly became Oakland, California's superintendent, and then Oakland's president of the school board. In the second part of the show, my guest, Gary Yee, describes what has to have been the most difficult experience for any superintendent, teachers engaging in a hunger strike in response to proposed school closures. I'm Peter Stiepelman, and this is An Imperfect Leader. Today on An Imperfect Leader, Dr. Gary Yee is my guest. And Gary is a special guest because his life and his work as a learner and a leader have taken place almost all in one spot, the Bay Area, Oakland, California, primarily. And I mean, you did have those 2 years as a professor at Boston College, but you are definitely Oakland through and through. And what do I mean by that? Well, born to Chinese working class immigrant parents, Gary attended Oakland's public schools. He graduated from UC Berkeley, he joined the US Air Force as a second lieutenant, and returned to Oakland in 1972 to be a teacher and then a principal. And he completed his doctorate at Stanford University and began a career as a professor and then dean to the vice chancellor, Peralta Community College. Gary was a member and also president of the Oakland School Board between the years of 2002 and 2023. And there was a hiatus there between 2013 and 2018. And what was happening during the hiatus? Well, this is interesting. In 2013, Gary was asked to become Oakland's superintendent after the superintendent left unexpectedly. Imperfect Leaders, please join me in welcoming Dr. Gary Yee to An Imperfect Leader. Gary, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be on this podcast with you.
Gary, it is a real joy to welcome you to the podcast. There are so many topics we could cover today. But one of them I was hoping to talk about is this perpetual challenge for school districts all across the nation, especially in those urban and metropolitan districts, superintendent turnover and political turmoil. This is a topic I know that is deeply personal for you. In fact, I know this became your research interest and your dissertation. I think it was Miracle Workers Wanted, Executive Succession and Organizational Change in an Urban School District. So I wonder, would you tell us a little bit about what you learned from your research?
Thank you, Peter. Well, first I had to dust off the research because I had it conducted in 1990 and I finished my dissertation in 1995. But the genesis of this interest was an article in Newsweek during that time that stated that urban school districts were in big trouble because the tenure of their superintendents was under 3 years. Well, I wanted to see if that was true and how different it was from the past. So I took the list of districts in the Council of Great City Schools, and I looked at 100 years worth of superintendents in their districts and the length of their tenures. It turns out that the average tenure was more like 5 years, slightly declining from about 7 years at the turn of the 19th century into the 1900s to about what it is today, or was it what it was in 1990, about 5 years. Looking at Oakland, the relatively short tenure of superintendents, the longest in the last 50 years was 5 years. Help me to reflect on who those superintendents, what they tried to achieve, and what lasted over time. And I learned quickly that the challenges of public education were persistent. The lasting improvements, academic achievement by most measures was unpredictable, and that you could guarantee that tenures were likely to be short, whether you were brought in from the outside or homegrown.
And why is that such a tall issue for school districts?
Well, what I found that it was a mix of two sides. One, it sounds a lot better in the press when people say the tenures are getting shorter and shorter because it suggests chaos and it suggests that nothing can be done because there's all this political infighting or sometimes corruption, or sometimes just ineptness of the superintendent. But at the same time, it's also true that the tenure of superintendents in large districts tends to be much shorter than the tenure in super of school districts which are smaller.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed in the conversations I've had and the observations I've made is that in urban and metropolitan districts in particular, that they have very tall tasks in terms of improving student achievement, improving attendance, improving graduation rates, holding on to teachers in terms of retaining great talent. And they put things in place that may be ambitious, and that the moment they leave, the next person comes in and says, well, we've got these achievement issues, we've got attendance issues, we've got graduation issues, we want to retain great talent, and so I'm going to do something about it. And they sometimes shift gears to create a new plan. And it seems to me that this idea of sustained positive growth is nearly impossible when there's a revolving door. And I wonder what you have noticed or experienced or in the conversations you've had either as a school board member or with other superintendents when you were playing the, not playing the role, serving as a superintendent.
Well, one of the exceptions to the superintendent churn in California is Long Beach. Long Beach has had a series of long tenured superintendents and a lot of steadiness, and the results in Long Beach have been pretty remarkable. At the same time, we can't import the sociological and ecological and political climate of one city into the to another. So it's pretty obvious that in Oakland, we've had quite a bit of superintendent churn. I think that it's both an indication of the tension of a changing community, and Oakland clearly has changed over the 50 years or 60 years that I've been involved. It's been changing, and the quest for political and economic and social power and authority and legitimacy in Oakland has been shifting over that period of time. But somewhere along the line, most of us believe that public school systems are the answer to those problems of shift and tension and conflict. And I think that part of it is we ourselves promote that we are the answer. And at the same time, when we look at our communities, the question is, if it's not the school, then what could it be?
That's actually really interesting, is that we do see ourselves as the great equalizer, as a way to level the playing field, as a way to promote success for individuals, for their futures. And we also then also get a lot of the tension and the blame for things that aren't going well throughout the entire community. And we have to somewhat reassert that we are part of a greater system, and that we are all interconnected, and that there are issues that do, you know, impact and influence what we are capable of doing in the hours that we have children.
And one of the most important findings in my own research and just in my experiencing, observing the history of superintendencies in Oakland, is the importance of that community connection, not only to say to the community, yes, we want to be part of the social change that's happening in the community, especially positive change, but then inviting the community to come to the schools and say, yes, we actually want you to help us be part of that change in our school. At the same time, when the community comes in, there's an expectation that the community can help dictate what schools will be like. And you and I know that schools, public school systems, have a dual purpose of being a public good, that is wisely spending the taxpayers' money, and a private good, that is helping parents to get their kids into the best possible a future for themselves, whether it's a high value, high ranking four-year college, or maybe an excellent career in town, in public service, or in a private business.
You know, you bring up one other point that I think that you are alluding to, which is sometimes there isn't this shared image of what terms or words mean. And so sometimes when there is an advisory, that there isn't a shared image about what that word means. And advisory sometimes is understood to be by those in the advisory as decision makers, as opposed to providing advice and counsel so that administration and teachers can make the very best decision. And we'll get to that, I'm sure, because I know in advance what your after action review is. And so I want to tempt or to say to those who are listening, really be prepared for a wild ride when it comes to Gary's after action review. So we'll get there in a minute. In my book and in the leadership model that I use to advise others, there's a dimension. It's called nested patterns. And that is the muscle of an organization's work. And inside that dimension, there's a term, shared leadership. And often when we talk about transformational leadership, we strike a very clear distinction between reform and transformation. Reform, for example, see coaching as a way to ensure compliance. Whereas transformational leadership, it sees peer coaching, sharing the leadership. These are essential. And learning more about you, you have seen the importance of shared leadership from the perspective of a board member and as a superintendent. And so I wonder, would you speak to the notion that systems change at the district level can happen, but it requires a shared leadership team of superintendent and its school board?
That's so true. I love you prompting me to think about shared leadership, because frankly, when I started as a teacher, I wasn't that interested in shared leadership. I just wanted to basically close the door and teach. When I was in my school as a principal, I wanted to be sure that I kept the superintendent as far away from my school as possible, except when I needed something, and that the leadership that I was exerting was because I was a trust leader of the school with a knowledge base and experience to help the school go in a particular direction. I was particularly fortunate that the first school that I was principal at actually had quite a bit of teacher leadership. We took a period of time in the country when we were talking about shared decision-making, teacher leadership. This was the 1990s. And so I began gradually to learn the importance of that shared leadership within the school, but I wasn't really familiar with the importance of shared leadership with a larger net, and that larger net being a school district, and the larger even on that is the school board and the people in the community that influence the election of those school board members. So I think shared leadership is something that it took me a while to learn. And when I first met you in 2002, and I was running for the school board, I really didn't understand shared leadership until probably 50 years into my career as a public educator. But I certainly believe it and know that it is the essential characteristic of sustained, successful growth and development in any public school system.
You know, it's not easy to do, right? We operate in this very hierarchical system that has really relatively been unchanged for the 100 plus years that it's been in existence. And so school boards and its superintendent, if they're not working together, supporting each other, and it is a reciprocal arrangement where the superintendent does have to support its board and the board does have to stand with its superintendent, if they're not doing that together, it sort of compels the superintendent to say, I'm going to go look for another place, or the board to say, this person is just a maverick and not working with us, so we need to move in a different direction. And so I wonder, what advice do you have for leaders seeking ways to engage in shared leadership?
Well, I really appreciate you pushing me and thinking about this, because when you're in either of those positions, you just assume that that's the world that you see. But you asking me to be on this podcast made me think about what it is that I actually learned, not only in real life on the job of being on the school board and being the superintendent, but just in my ability to observe what's going on in other districts. So I took the liberty of building five bullets around this topic, and I hope you don't mind. The first is that school districts cannot improve without a leader, a superintendent, who clearly communicates what that looks like. Then I got to thinking, Peter, that school boards and superintendents should be leading together, shared leadership. Finally, to talk about nested. In Oakland, as you probably know, the community, the state, and national policies, as well as initiative can entice or they can undermine the local efforts of a school district. Having said all that, I just wanted to refer to my mentor or my model for superintendents, and that's Dr. Marcus Foster. You know, Peter, he came to Oakland with great promise from 1970 to 1973, came not as a superintendent, but as assistant superintendent. He came to Oakland with a vision to open up the district to the community. His tenure only lasted 3 years because, as you know, he was assassinated by the Symbionese Liberation Army at the end of a board meeting. But the amazing thing about Dr. Foster's vision was that it was continued all the way through from 1970 to the present, when Dr. Tony Smith in 2010 argued that what we should be, as his strategic vision, was a full-service community school district. So, you know, it's just so ironic that we have had a period of a 50-year period of short-tenured superintendents, and yet that notion of community schools is still an aspiration that has continued through.
Gary, what does the term an imperfect leader mean to you?
That's the second question that you asked that really prompted me to reflect on 60 years of leadership. So I ended up in four more bullets, Peter. First, I think an imperfect leader expresses the real limits of the superintendent or the board's influence. The public's expectations for academic excellence, social equity, fiscal efficiency are immense but impossible to attain by the public schools alone. The imperfection of the imperfect leader has as much to do with public education as an efficient use of the taxpayers' money versus the community's expectation that public education will solve the inequality that is the legacy of our country's founding, and to the parents' focus on, will their kid get a great education that will make them eligible for a great university? Imperfect also means calls out the importance of humility, personal humility. You know, all the metaphors that people use about public education, especially a superintendent, tend to be often metaphors of war, like a battle to be won against the illiteracy.
It's a poor metaphor because we're not in battle. The metaphor should be we're in concert. It should be more of a symphony or a dance where we're working on the choreography together, and it's something beautiful that we're creating, or a mosaic that we are creating, stitching or placing each stone in its place to reveal a beautiful picture. I'm sorry to interrupt. Idea of battle.
You're absolutely right, but if you think about the public press on public education now, how many metaphors are there about battles and protection and a war on the side that maybe you and I would support? It's a war against inequity and illiteracy, but for other people, it's a war on personal parental rights. You know, all that language is now about battle. And we characterize the people, kids, parents, employees, unions, administrators, as the enemy instead as the allies. The third is imperfection of leadership, at least in an urban district, is the importance of time. That any effort to be perfect requires more than a year, and certainly more than a strategic plan, because it's really about implementation. And the irony is, think about how long it takes us to demonstrate perfection in education, starting from preschool now, all the way to high school graduation. We're talking now maybe 14, 15 years. So what superintendent lasts for 14 or 15 years? So he can say, do you remember what I said 14 or 15 years ago? Here's the result. Let me introduce you to the graduating class of 2024. The fourth is the importance of others, and this is your shared leadership. This is not about ourselves as individuals, and that's what I learned because, as you know, I went back to grad school because I wanted to be the miracle worker. But instead, what I found is that leadership, being more perfect, means that it's less about you and it's more about the team It's more about the person who replaces you. It's about the board who supervises you. It's about the community who pays the bill. And it's about the allies in the community whose experiences and whose goal is brings you closer to perfection.
And we'll be right back. Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being, and I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of An Imperfect Leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class, and the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions. Maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. We're back for segment two of An Imperfect Leader called Imperfect Leadership in After Action. And my guest is Dr. Gary Yee, former school board member and superintendent of the Oakland Unified School District. And in this segment, we ask our guests to deconstruct a decision that they had to make, and then we discuss it. So Gary, what happened?
Well, first, Peter, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to reflect on what was a very hard time in my life. And I think that every retired education leader, educator, should have the opportunity to be on your podcast so they can think about how they spent the last 30, 40, or 50 years of their life. Go back to 2018. In 2018, after a major budget crisis in Oakland requiring mid-year cuts, and you know how hard that is, and the discussion around a number of school closures, which we thought were required, my local district board member announced that she was leaving after 4 years and asked me to return. Now, remember, I retired after that my 1 year as superintendent. In my contested election, I stated my priorities were, one, to build a sustainable budget, two, to allow consideration of school consolidations as a budget and academic tool, and above all else, support and maintain the integrity of the superintendent. Now, the superintendent at the time was only in her second year as superintendent. However, she was a homegrown Oakland native, and she had worked in the school district for 20 years. So in 2021, I was elected the president of the board, but the budget deficit continued to grow. We heard again about the need to consolidate schools and finally approved by a 4-3 vote a proposal from the superintendent recommending that we close and merge up to 15 out of 100 schools over a 2-year period, beginning in the fall of that year. They were mostly underperforming and under-enrolled schools. Nearly everybody in the community knew which schools they were and the challenges that they had faced over the last 10 years. And they were mostly in historically Black and brown neighborhoods.
You hear often that, yes, I recognize we have a budget shortfall. Yes, I recognize we have under-enrolled and underperforming schools. Yes, I recognize that a revolving door of top leadership is a real challenge, and we have to do everything we can to support the vision and the direction that they want to travel. And they will say, "Oh, but if it impacts me, no, don't do that." So I imagine that is exactly what you encountered.
Well, in Oakland, not only was it the way you described it was perfect, but there were accusations that school consolidations was a continuation of racist community behaviors, including residential segregation and gentrification. And school closures was the next step in completing the gentrification process. We also had demonstrations at the board at that time to defund our local school police force in favor of funding more restorative practices. So all year, there were many demonstrations at the schools and at school board meetings and on Zoom, of course. Board meetings were shut down. We had several incidences where there were public demonstrations at our homes. Some board members supported the demonstrations, going into the audience during the meeting to express their support for the communities or the speakers' positions. Instead of getting public support from other elected city and state officials, I have to tell you that there was lots of public pressure from them to slow down the closures because it was a election season for them. But in private, they understood the need for closures and mergers and asked if we could limit them to 6 instead of 15. But we, as a board, majority of 4, held firm. In January that year, the last year of my 4-year term, I was elected school board, president of the school board. We had begun the process of closing the schools that year. But in February, 2 teachers of one of the middle schools started a hunger strike, demanding that the board rescind its vote and vowing to not take another bite of food, even if it meant his death. They set up a tent in front of the school, but the narrow board majority continued to vote to stay the course in support of the superintendent's 2-year-long research and planning process to consolidate the schools and address the estimated $50 million budget deficit. After the second week of their strike, and some efforts by individual board members to meet with the strikers to find a solution, or at least to listen, it was apparent that the strikers' demands remained the same, and only the board could rescind its vote. On or about the 18th day of the strike, one of their supporters, though, called me to share that their situation of the strikers was getting severe and they wanted to talk with me. I found that to be the opening that I needed. So I agreed to meet with them upon the condition that it was private in the evening with only the 2 strikers, my chosen board colleague, and their representative. From my perspective, there were 4 issues. 1, the strikers were employees, and I worried about their declining health. 2, the fiscal health of the district was paramount, and we needed to have the option to close schools to reduce the deficit. 3, the board's support for the recommendations of the superintendent and her staff was important, and for us to ensure that our superintendent was staying, it seemed to me it was important for the board to act in accordance with her recommendations. And finally, I was concerned about my own authority as a board president. But nevertheless, we went to the next meeting the next evening to the classroom at the school. They met my requirement for a private meeting, and I found that as a good sign. We started with about 2 hours of storytelling, our own personal histories, our values, our shared values, and the conditions for ending the hunger strike. It was clear that the gap was still there, but we came down to serious negotiations. While they knew that I would not support the rescission, their demand, I was frankly concerned by their health, not so much just for their physical health, but their emotional and psychological well-being and the well-being of our school district. I had determined that they were both sincere because they had good reputations as educators, and they believed that closing the school and any schools was against their professional and personal values. We were at an impasse, but you know what? I began to see them as colleagues and not as opponents. In the 3rd hour, I offered an alternative. I would call a special board meeting to take up a vote by one of their board supporters to rescind the decision to close, if they would pledge to me that they would end the hunger strike an hour before that special board meeting. They reluctantly agreed, and we left knowing that I needed to communicate the plan to the superintendent. So I let her know my decision and set up the special board meeting for the next day. I was pretty sure that there were sufficient votes to reject the motion to rescind, but who could tell, given the public pressure and the political pressure. An hour before the meeting, I was told that one of the strikers had broken his hunger strike, and so I felt comfortable holding the meeting, not knowing the result of the vote. Well, I can tell you, because I'm sure you're with bated breath, over 1,000 people attended the Zoom meeting, and several hundred signed up for public comment. We listened for several hours, including listening to the strikers. But when we voted, the vote was to reject the motion to rescind. The outcry after the vote was immediate and volatile. The strikers said that they had been tricked into ending the strike. Others in the audience actually volunteered to take up the strike themselves. Students said that they would not return to school, but the hunger strike was over. The week after the strike, tensions remained high and there was vocal night demonstrations with graffiti at my house and rocks thrown through a window. Internet lines were cut at the home of one of my fellow board members. Weeks later, another vote was taken to revise the number of schools closed or merged for the year from 6 to 3, with the other 3 schools to be closed in the semester afterwards. It was definitely a political compromise. Soon after that vote, one board member left in disgust at the need to compromise yet again, and the number of consolidating schools went from the original 15 to 11, then the 6, then 3. Still, we were finally able to adopt a 3-year budget that was positive, at least for the first 2 years, but very cautionary in the out years. While the number of schools was down to 3, one in particular became another Occupy situation over the summer, when community members, including parents of the school, took over the school and refused to leave after the end of the school year, saying that they were staying at the school site 24/7 and maintaining what they called a freedom school at the site. The board members that fall, 2022, became focused on school closures, where a slate of candidates ran with the promise to rescind all remaining school closures unless certain conditions for community participation were met. They subsequently won their elections, and the first order of business for them on the new board was to rescind the remaining consolidations. By then, I had retired from the board, but I watched in dismay.
If anyone has not sort of pulled over with their eyes sort of wide open to think, what can happen when you have to make really hard decisions and you are faced with not just strong opposition but aggressive opposition, I don't know what else to say.
Well, the 4 issues that I brought up earlier, the last one was I was concerned about my own authority as a board president. And what I recognize is that my authority as a board president has to do with my own personal integrity. And it did not have to do with declaring the strikers as my enemy or the occupiers as my enemy. And what maybe I'm somewhat proudest of in this after-action review was because I bear no malice to the people who took those actions. And I think that in the long run, if I gave that up, and I assume that they, in fact, were the enemy because they were deceitful or they were harmful, then I would have actually lost. And so in my own heart, I believe that that was the most important part of board leadership that I want to communicate on this podcast.
How do you get there then? One of my questions is, what did you learn about relationships or what new relationships were formed? I think that to a lesser degree, what you experience is well beyond what almost any of us experience. And I'm curious, when you give advice to others, how do you get to this place where you really are human-centered, that this is not something you took personally, and yet they were really attacking you and your integrity?
There's 3 things. The first was I had a network of, you might call it the silent majority, but a network who may have disagreed with my decision, but were always with me. They understood the heart of me because I was from the community. The second is I had a working relationship with the superintendent, and I was determined not to throw her under the bus. The third is, Peter, I had no idea that this is what I was going to say to you today. It was only the fact that you encouraged me to do this after-action review about this particular topic that I was able to come to terms and to heal within myself. I have not yet gone to see or to meet with the two hunger strikers or to the people who did the occupy of the school during the summer. But I know that I bear them no malice because from their own perspective, they were doing the heroic thing. But that's what this whole podcast is about, the podcast system that you've developed and the work that you've been doing, Peter, is to professionalize and normalize the importance of having this investigation, exploration of each of the people who want to be or seek to be in the positions that I'm describing to you. But how can we continue to move the school district in our city if we haven't first come to terms and made peace with the people that we serve and that we serve with?
What could you have done differently? As you've looked back and have thought about this, was there something that you have considered about what could have been different, what you could have done differently?
My biggest disappointment with myself and maybe with us as a system is that we did not do enough analysis of the potential cost savings and the problem of having too many under-enrolled, underperforming schools. The research on this has been very sparse, and it usually says that school consolidations were failures because they didn't save any money and they didn't help to improve the performance of the schools. But I know in my heart professionally, and probably those who are listening to the podcast or that you are associated with, most of us believe that this is an important tool to use for fiscal sustainability. I've yet to hear a superintendent say to me that it wouldn't have been beneficial to resize or right size the district. But most of us would say, but it's not worth a political battle. But I think part of that is because we haven't developed as a profession the importance and the knowledge and the experience of how to do it correctly. And so that's my biggest regret, that I didn't have the tools or I didn't have the partners who were willing to do the analysis for us as a whole, respected economic elders and political elders in the community, and say, yes, actually, this is an important tool to have in your box.
I can hear that. And as you're speaking, I was thinking of the sort of the mantra that I have tried to use with others, which is you make decisions with the people most impacted, and how it might have been different if perhaps the communities whose schools might have been, who were on the list to be closed, if they could have been a part of that, with that statement that you made right at the end there, that we will accept the results of, or the conclusions that are drawn by these experts about whether or not it's in the best interest of our community or the children, or that we will be able to improve programming, be able to hold on to teachers, be able to have full-time nurses, whatever it is that is important to the community, because you do that work together. What's important to us? What do we want to create together? And how that might have resulted in, while it would have been tough potentially to hear that their school was going to be closed, that it would have been more acceptable, maybe not there would still be opposition, but at least you may have had some partners in that.
And Peter, the thing is I can accept the opposition of parents and kids and people who are directly impacted, where schools are the private good that they rely on as a leg up in their own family's opportunities. You know, those are natural and they're just expressions of worry and fear. But it's us as the elected officials, the board members, the superintendent, and the state and local government that have to take up the challenge that they themselves, that we ourselves have created, which is, yes, we want everything for our schools. No, we don't have ways to pay for it. And yes, we have a history of
postponing tough decisions, right? And it's also a history of saying, well, let somebody else worry about it. I'm in this position for now, and I want to do other things. And what I don't want to do are some really tough things.
Right. So I think that is the responsibility of leadership, to accept that and not to demonize those who are fighting, you know, for their classroom or for their teacher in their neighborhood, even though they are not aware that they could get a better education one school over. And, you know, several of your earlier interviewers, you know, talked about situations. Like one in particular in Hartford, Connecticut. You know, that was such a positive story about school consolidation. I don't think Oakland would ever get to that place, because in my own history in the school district of 20 and 30 years, we've confronted this in a variety of ways, extended the time, worked on building support. In the end, it was necessary for a board to take action. And in most cases, boards have a difficult time making that decision, because we're neighbors and we're colleagues, and we want to live in the community and be seen as supporters, not as closers.
Typically, we end with what was something that was good that came out of this situation. I'm not sure there's a silver lining as much as
there is. Our superintendent, Dr. Kyla Johnson Chermel, is starting her sixth year as the superintendent of the Oakland Public Schools. This homegrown African-American woman, deeply spiritual, deeply professional, will be the longest serving superintendent in Oakland since 1950.
That is a silver lining, particularly when you look at the statistics nationwide of superintendents and their tenures, particularly women of color. 6 years is phenomenal. My guest again was Dr. Gary Yee, a teacher, a leader, a professor, a school board member, a superintendent, and a friend. Imperfect Leaders, Gary and I met in 2002 when he was running for office. He mentioned that a little bit earlier, and I didn't say anything. At that time, I was a third grade teacher, and I went to his campaign kickoff in the neighborhood where I was teaching. And all these years later, in part because of this podcast, I've gotten to have a reunion of sorts. So, you know, Gary, I'm so happy to have had this conversation with you. Really, your heart for children is undeniable, and what you've been through tests your faith, challenges these deep wells of empathy and compassion that I know you for. And to have known you then and to know you now is really such a privilege that I will never forget. And your message that the relationship between boards and superintendents is paramount, that is so important. And so I just, from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you for being on the podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you for helping me to make sense of this last 5 years. Without this podcast, this would all be just mixed up in emotion and not actually contributing to my own personal well-being as I approach the real end of my career.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader. Leadership in After Action.